It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time tomorrow is the statewide election for the next Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice. The editor of PolitiFact Wisconsin joins us to fact-check the candidates.
First, as presidential candidates continue to chase voters in Wisconsin, a national disability advocacy organization has looked into how candidates differ on their policies to support people with disabilities.
Americans with Disabilities has some of the highest unemployment rates, substantially higher than the population as a whole.
Wisconsin is faring better than a lot of other states in the country. The number of people with disabilities who have jobs is higher than the national average.
Lauren Applebaum joins us now. She's director of communications at Respectability, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that advocates for people with disabilities, especially those in or looking to enter the workforce. Lauren, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, Lauren, tell us, what's the goal of this questionnaire that you gave to the candidates, the People with Disabilities Vote questionnaires?
Sure. So in the past, people with disabilities have been a forgotten demographic. Presidential candidates as well as down ballot candidates talk about other demographics such as the African Americans or Hispanic Americans, but often forget people with disabilities, which make up 1 in 5 Americans. So that's 20% of the U.S. population has a disability. So our goal is for the presidential campaigns to be talking about and to and including this group of people because we want to be included just like any other group.
And as we mentioned, one main issue that you focus on, though not the only issue, is employment for people with disabilities. What should candidates be paying attention to when it comes to employment?
Sure. So in terms of, they need to really think about how they can help the 70% of the people with disabilities who are unemployed. You mentioned in Wisconsin that you are higher than a national average. Nearly 40% of people with disabilities in Wisconsin are employed. The average is closer to 30%. But there still is a gap of 41% between people with disabilities unemployment rate and people without disabilities unemployment rate. So it's important to then take a look at some best practices. And Wisconsin actually has some really good examples. Under the leadership of Governor Walker and through the Department of Workforce Development, Wisconsin has rapidly expanded its school-to-work transition programs for youth with a variety of disabilities. One of these is Project Search. Wisconsin is working toward having 27 Project Search sites serving youth with a wide variety of different disabilities. Through Project Search, young Wisconsinites are succeeding in a variety of jobs in hospitals, elder care, and hospitality at a 70% success rate following this year-long program of finding full-time employment. And so presidential candidates should take a look at these best practices that are found in a variety of states and see how they can implement them should they become president of the United States.
Talking to Lauren Applebaum with the group Respectability. Her organization gave a questionnaire to presidential candidates, part of a wake-up call in a way to try to get politicians to pay attention to issues facing Americans with disabilities. Well, let's get into this questionnaire. Now, you sent it to all major party political campaigns. Of the candidates left, who answered this questionnaire?
Sure. So of the 5 candidates remaining, both Democrats, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, have filled out the entire questionnaire. And of the Republicans who are remaining, only Governor Kasich has responded. We have made several requests of Senator Cruz and businessman Donald Trump, but we have not received any responses from them yet in terms of answers.
Well, let's get into what you have heard from the candidates who did respond and start with Hillary Clinton's campaign. What kind of signals did she send in her answers to your questions?
Sure. So Hillary Clinton's campaign has kind of talked about these issues on and off the campaign trail the entire time. She's had her autism plan, which has been focused. She included in her questionnaire. And then she talked about a lot of legislation that was passed during her time as a senator. And really, both she and Bernie Sanders have kind of gone into detail in outlining some of the things that they've done in the past.
And Bernie Sanders, you just mentioned, were there things that he said that maybe distinguished him from Secretary Clinton?
Yes. So, I mean, we, as a nonpartisan organization, we don't, you know, endorse or rate or pick one of over the other. But Bernie Sanders, and what I really loved about it was that Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders both kind of looked at it in different ways, in terms of, I mean, you just had on you earlier a story on the minimum wage, and as I was listening, and you're talking about how Bernie Sanders is pushing for, you know, $15 minimum wage for all, and Hillary Clinton just last week started talking about the importance of minimum wage raise be for all people, including people with disabilities, which Bernie Sanders just today talked about in a statement. And so they're both kind of pushing towards the same goal, which is what we really want all of the campaigns doing.
And then the other response you got, you said, I think it was a partial response from Governor John Kasich. What did he talk about?
Sure. Hold on one moment. I apologize. So Governor Kasich kind of answered several of the questions, talking about his role as governor of Ohio. He, on the trail as well, talks a lot about his job rates, as well as he has mentioned sheltered workshops in the past and his work to get people with disabilities employment in full-time integrated employment. And that was one of the things that he focused on in his questionnaire response.
You mentioned that Donald Trump and Senator Ted Cruz hadn't responded. Are you still holding out hope that they will answer the questions?
Yes, we will continue after each election. We do circle back each time, and we are hopeful that they will return some sort of response. In the meantime, we have attended events. We have a fellowship program of individuals with and without disabilities, and we sent a group of them to Iowa and New Hampshire, attending the town halls and asking candidates these questions and recording on video. So we do have both or all the candidates, including Senator Ted Cruz and Donald Trump, talking about some of these issues on video when our fellows have had the opportunity to ask them questions.
Big picture, why do you think people with disabilities tend to be overlooked in presidential campaigns? I mean, there's not a lot of debate conversation. If candidates talk about it, it's maybe more of an afterthought than a high-profile platform.
Yeah, it's a big shame. So part of it is that people with disabilities are not necessarily partisan. You have an opportunity kind of really to reach out because you have people who, you know, as I said, one in five Americans have a disability, but they kind of span. You have 52% of Democrats reporting that they or a loved one have a disability, 44% of Republicans, and then 58% of independents. So you would think that this would be a group that campaigns would really want to reach out to when you think of how many independents say that they or a loved one has a disability and would really kind of care about these issues. We've done focus groups and meetings with individuals with disabilities around the country, and we really hear from some individuals that they ask their campaigns, you know, from presidential all the way to down ballot, and people just aren't thinking about these issues. But there is a positive here. In the last cycle, no one really talked about disability issues. Mitt Romney didn't mention it at all, and now you have campaigns talking about it. Before, we had some candidates dropping out. We had several other Republicans, including Governor Jeb Bush, who had completed the questionnaire, really talking about these on the trail. And whoever becomes the nominee, we will continue working with to try and get both or all nominees, if we end up seeing a third party, to fill out this questionnaire, because people with disabilities really deserve to hear what the candidates are saying about these issues, and they really want to know. And it's important for the campaigns to ensure that there are events and materials are accessible for people with disabilities, from wheelchair sections at events to ensuring their pictures and videos have captions for people who are hard of hearing or needing screen readers. So our goal really is to get these campaigns thinking about all of the issues, because as they all say, they're reaching out to all Americans and want to represent the United States. So in order to do so, they really need to be accessible and reaching out to all Americans, including those with disabilities.
We'll leave it there for now. Lauren, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Lauren Applebaum, Director of Communications at the nonprofit group Respectability. She talked to us about responses to a questionnaire for presidential candidates on how they'd work for people with disabilities.
Coming up, we'll talk with the editor of PolitiFact Wisconsin about what the Supreme Court candidates have been saying leading up to tomorrow's election. This is Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll check out some of the most mispronounced words in the English language and whether or not getting it right matters.
Now we're gearing up for tomorrow's statewide elections. Voters will cast ballots in a couple different elections, including the nonpartisan state Supreme Court race. The two candidates are Rebecca Bradley, appointed to fill the vacancy left after the death of Justice Patrick Crooks, and Joanne Kloppenburg, a state appeals court judge.
PolitiFact has been keeping track of how truthful the candidates' statements are throughout their campaigns. Greg Borowski joins us now to review some of their claims. He's the editor of PolitiFact Wisconsin. Greg, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, happy to do it.
Well, let's start with a claim from Justice Rebecca Bradley. Here she is on the Joy Cardine Show in March talking about a time that she represented a former boyfriend in a family law case involving child custody.
And I was helping out a friend. This is something that lawyers do on a regular basis. They help out friends or family members who need assistance in these types of cases.
And at issue there, that statement that she made, this is something that lawyers do on a regular basis, help out friends in this type of case. So you were looking at that. How did you start?
Well, we took a look at kind of the context of her statement and her situation, which is different from, you know, say a lawyer helping someone with a speeding ticket or a family friend. I mean, she was talking about a very particular situation, a custody matter, a family law case, and so forth. And we went out and talked to, you know, five, you know, really long-time people who are familiar with that system, and none of them could recall this happening on a regular basis as the justice described, so we rated that statement false.
One of the judges that you spoke to said that he thought that it was something that had happened. So how did you weigh that aspect?
Yeah, well, we took a look at that. I mean, it was, I think that in the Justice Bradley's claim and her statement was she was emphasizing how common it was, and she said, you know, this is something that lawyers do on a regular basis. So even though that the one expert had said, well, yeah, I've seen it on occasion, it didn't seem like a regular sort of thing as you know, something that would commonly happen in a family law case or with that sort of, you know, level of involvement between the two parties.
And the other four judges that you talked to about this particular aspect, did you get the sense about whether they were saying, no, I haven't seen this, or no, this would be really, really unusual?
Well, a little of both. I think they said that they were not familiar with ever having seen it, but also that it, you know, wouldn't, you know, be common, because it's one of these situations where I think if you're practicing in that realm for, you know, many years, you're bound to, you know, have a pretty good impression of what, you know, what is or isn't common like that. So again, we just found at the end of the day the evidence wasn't there to support Justice Bradley's claim, and we had rated it false.
We're going to move on to another. This from that same interview on the Joy Cardine Show from back in March from Rebecca Bradley. And this one, Bradley was getting at how Kloppenburg would approach her role on the Supreme Court as Bradley sees it.
Given her judicial philosophy, Joanne Kloppenburg has told us she thinks it's her job to promote a more equal society.
So again, the key part of that statement, her job to promote a more equal society, and that this is going to inform how she does her job as a judge on the Supreme Court. How did you go about rating that one?
Well, that wasn't too hard to track down, because right on Judge Kloppenburg's website, she has a, you know, pretty detailed, you know, meaty paragraph or two about her judicial philosophy, and at the end of it, she talks about her duty is to uphold the Constitution, a sacred document that represents the will of the people, which contains fundamental principles that define our democracy, protect individual rights, and promote a more equal society. So our rating was mostly true, because we felt it needed the statement was accurate, but needed some additional information, namely that, you know, she, Judge Kloppenburg, was saying it in the context of her philosophy is to uphold the Constitution, and it's the Constitution which she views as promoting a more equal society, rather than it was her job to sort of directly, you know, make decisions that promote equality.
Now, this is a nonpartisan race, as we said, but both candidates in this case have given cues, signals to the electorate about how they understand the political spectrum, what their inclinations might be. And you also found some documentation from Joanne Kloppenburg about the justices that she identifies with the most. What did you find?
Yeah, I mean, she described several of the Supreme Court justices. I know Justice Ginsburg, and I'm blanking at the moment on the other here, Sonia Sotomayor, as ones that she, you know, admires in part, she said, because they believe in protecting individual rights and promoting a more equal society. So she sort of held them out, and these are, of course, two appointees by Democratic presidents and would align more on the liberal side of the U.S. Supreme Court that she's identifying with. And we felt that was just a little further evidence to bolster the claim from Justice Bradley that we were looking at, which we rated mostly true.
Do you have a sense how that claim is fitting into each candidate's campaign?
Well, I mean, I think what Justice Bradley, of course, is and her supporters are saying is, look, Joanne Kloppenburg isn't one to sort of take an impartial thing, that they view her, she'd be advocating for, you know, more liberal causes and come down on that side of the rulings. And, you know, it's just saying, look, here, I think they were highlighting that phrase in particular because it seems for someone to hear it, it sounds like someone's trying to, you know, kind of put their thumb on the scale of justice a little bit and to balance it out rather than just treat the case as it comes. So they're certainly, on the Bradley side, I think, using that as an indication of, hey, look, you know, Judge Kloppenburg isn't going to be as fair as she says. She has an end game in mind, that being to promote this more equal society.
We're talking with Greg Borowski right now, editor of PolitiFact Wisconsin, looking at claims made by both sides in the state's upcoming Supreme Court election. And now we're going to take a look at a statement from Joanne Kloppenburg on her campaign website. She claims that in the primary election, a right-wing group spent more than $100 million to support Rebecca Bradley. So a large number there. How did you tackle that one?
Well, we started by trying to figure out in a lot of political elections and campaigns these days, of course, there's been discussion of dark money, which is these groups that don't have to disclose who's giving them money or how they're spending it. There was action in this race by various groups. And in this case, though, the group being identified, the Wisconsin Alliance for Reform, didn't spend that much money. There are indications where they spent about $1 million in the primary election, or somewhat, you know, maybe a little bit less than that. And when we went to the Kloppenburg campaign, it was sort of the big, you know, oops, we had a bad number on there, that they meant to have it, you know, to just say $1 million rather than $100 million. So we rated the claim false because, you know, clearly if someone group had spent $100 million on a campaign, you would have heard a lot more from them in terms of ads and, you know, direct mail and robocalls and all the other things. That $100 million is quite a bit of money. And that, so this claim was, you know, well off base, and we rated it false.
So the Kloppenburg campaign hadn't caught that until you brought it to them?
They had not. You know, they said, you know, sort of after we indicated it to them, then they took it down from the website. Well, I guess I should say they corrected it to $1 million rather than $100 million.
And what is the actual amount that we're talking about here? $1 million, and do we know who was spending that money?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know precisely. There's different groups like the Democracy Campaign and others that try to analyze it based on how much, you know, say, you know, TV ads are being purchased, because there's a way to sort of, you know, triangulate and figure out if this is what they're spending on this area, that this is approximately what they're spending overall. And the group was the Wisconsin Alliance for Reform, which has run a series of TV ads and radio ads that have been targeting Judge Kloppenburg and some past rulings she's made, and doing that in order to advance Justice Bradley's campaign.
And we've got one last one here that you looked into. This is another claim from Kloppenburg, this from a TV ad released in mid-March. And the claim here that Justice Bradley skipped court for an event with lobbyists. Here's a clip.
The Republican Party is helping pay for Bradley's campaign, and she recently skipped court to attend an event paid for by Walker's lobbyist friends.
All right, there it is, the claim. How do you rate that one?
Well, we rated that one mostly true because, in large parts of it are true. We felt like the part that wasn't was the, it was maybe a little misleading, was the skips court, which would suggest that she, avoided a session entirely. What happened was Justice Bradley left court before it was done in order to get to her speech before the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce Group.
15 minutes early, right?
Right. And she said she went back and reread the material that came up after that. So we just felt like that part of it, to say she skipped court, was overstating it. And so that's why we came at mostly true on that one.
And what about the lobbyist friends part?
Yeah, I mean, that part, I mean, it is true. She was going to speak to the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce Group, which had been and is a big supporter of Governor Scott Walker. So, I mean, the ad uses some of the language you'd expect in a TV ad. These aren't just a lobbyist group. It's the lobbying friends of Scott Walker and all that. But it's but that part, was accurate. She did speak to a group that was supportive of Scott Walker.
Greg, thanks so much for joining us.
You're quite welcome.
That was Greg Borowski, editor of PolitiFact Wisconsin. He joined us there to take a look at what the state Supreme Court candidates have been saying throughout their campaigns.
Coming up after the news, from prescription to moot, we'll talk about the words we often mispronounce and why they trip us up. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. A recent survey by the Daily Mail found that 82% of Britons frequently mispronounce words. Common examples include espresso for espresso and prescription for prescription.
The British have some company in this country where anyone who speaks any language will tell you, hey, words get mispronounced all the time. In fact, that's part of the package deal with languages, according to our next guest, who says being a stickler for correct pronunciation can be a form of snobbery, maybe even shorthand for race or class bias. That said, it's always fun to talk about language and what we might be getting wrong and right, including pronouncing language on the airwaves.
Oh, well. Well, Martha Barnett is with us now. She does not judge you, Rob. She's the co-host of the public radio show Away With Words. Martha, welcome back.
Hi, y'all. Good to be here.
So, Martha, does it matter if we're mispronouncing a word or not?
Great question. I will tell you that pronunciation is intensely personal, and I cannot tell you the number of times that people have called our radio show and talked about a pronunciation that they said just made their skin crawl or felt like fingernails on a chalkboard. You're right. The thing that you said in your introduction about the fact that sometimes pronunciation just reflects where we come from and how we were raised. And I think the real key to getting exercise about pronunciation is if it messes up your spelling.
So that's the key. If the way we pronounce it makes us then turn and spell something wrong, that's when people should get worried?
Yeah, I think so. Otherwise, a lot of pronunciation is pretty subjective, and a lot of it is changing all the time. I was reading an article, in fact, the other day about pronunciation, and it was saying that a lot of us make a mistake when we pronounce some word or other. I don't remember what it was, but what they said was the E-R-R. The word was E-R-R. Now, how do you guys pronounce it?
I err in the pronunciation,
and
not do you err?
You
does
err.
Err?
Uh-huh.
I try not to say it because I'm never sure how to pronounce that.
Yeah,
I talk around
words.
It. To err, right?
Exactly.
To err is human?
Yeah. You say err?
I guess so, if I had to.
I do too. But guess what? I wasn't sure of myself either. And even as I was thinking about it, I just couldn't remember if it was air or err, and I looked it up in a number of manuals. And do you know that linguistic authorities are still holding on to that? To err is human?
Huh. I did not know that.
You would think it would be like error or errant, but no, the traditional pronunciation for a long time was err. And, you know, William Safire once said that when enough of us say it wrong, we'll be right. And more of us are saying it as air, and I imagine that in another generation it will be air. But, you know, that's just a perfect example of someplace where I got tripped up.
Well, right, that's the classic example of what language does, isn't it? It's fluid, and if enough people say it maybe incorrectly, then the common speak changes, and that's the right way.
Exactly. And you know, the example I gave of spelling was reflected, wasn't it last week that there, did you all read about this, that Tracy McCreary, a state mm-hmm. representative in Missouri, introduced a bill? You read about this?
I did, yeah. She did, her colleagues in the legislature were saying fiscal incorrectly.
Yes, they were saying physical when they were supposed to say fiscal. And I can see where that would possibly lead to a problem with spelling. Of course, the funny thing is that, you know, I said that she's a state representative in Missouri, but I'm sure that there are Missouri people who would get on me for not saying Missouri.
Well, now, some of the words we mispronounce, a lot of us do the same thing, and maybe it's going to change over time. But it seems like there's a whole other category where there's the unique ones. And I think I've mentioned this one to you before, where for years I had read the word ancient and locked in my head that this is a word you say, ancient. And that's just flat out wrong. There was no, it's not like, that's not a gray area. A lot of us have our own little unique words that we just say wrong, right?
Right. Right. And if you think about it, I mean, pronunciation is a habit, right? We learn it really, really early. And sometimes we work to learn a pronunciation. And then when we hear somebody else pronounce it some different way, then we think, what? How could that possibly be? They're wrong. And they aren't necessarily, but in your case, you are.
And I want to be tolerant, Martha. I really do. But can you correct Rob on something for
Uh-oh.
Me?
I know where this is going.
Begin this way. I want to be tolerant. But
how would you pronounce the name of the Beatle
who played
the drums?
The first name.
The Beatle who plays the drums. You mean Ringo Starr?
Correct. I would certainly say it was Ringo Starr.
And I say Ringo too, just like everybody else. See,
what?
Ringo.
Ring. Do you really?
I think it's such a subtle point that I don't hit the G hard enough that I wonder at one who would make a big deal about it.
So what are those four things on your hands?
Rings. Not rings.
Well, what are wearing the rings?
Ring what? My fingers.
Oh, not fingers?
Fingers. Okay. Interesting. Okay. I wonder why you say Ringo. I've never heard that one. But I'm fascinated that you do.
Huh. I'm not convinced I'm wrong.
Fascinating. She's being kind.
Yeah. We're talking about mispronunciations and gray areas that are acceptable in many ways with Martha Barnett from the radio show Away With Words. You can hear her, by the way, Sunday mornings at 9 here on the Ideas Network. So we mentioned, you say this can be sometimes over-focusing on pronunciation could be a shorthand for maybe some kind of prejudice, Martha.
Well, sure. We just grow up with these preoccupations about this or that pronunciation. And, I mean, think about the word et cetera. I mean, some people say, or it's two words, right, et cetera. Some people say et cetera. Mm. And I can see where people could get snobby about that one because they're not realizing, apparently, that et cetera is actually two Latin words that literally mean and the rest. And so, yeah, it's to some degree, sometimes pronunciations can be a badge of education, but you sure as heck better make sure that you have it correct if you're going to correct somebody. There's something called Hartman's Law of Prescriptivist Retaliation. Mm-hmm. Have you heard of this one?
No. Mm-mm.
It goes, any article or statement about correct grammar, punctuation, or spelling is bound to contain at least one error. And that holds true for pronunciation as well. I can't tell you the number of times we get emails from people who are exercised about this or that mispronunciation, but in the message header, it will say grammar spelled with an E rather than a final A. So you got to be careful when you're correcting people.
Well, Martha, you sent us a list of your top 10 or so, and on your list was the word M-O-O-T. What are you hearing people do with that one?
Moot, as in a moot point. A lot of people are saying a mute point, which sort of makes sense. Mm. If you're talking about a moot point, you're talking about something that is hypothetical. And that one, too, might be a measure of education, because a moot point is a hypothetical point of discussion that's used as a teaching exercise for law students, and it goes back to in England, M-O-O-T, moot, was an assembly of people, and so you can see how that would lead to the notion of people discussing things and arguing. But some people say a mute point, meaning a silent point. And you can sort of see how that makes sense, but that is incorrect. And the other one that's not correct along those lines is moo point. I don't know if you're a fan of Friends, but on the show Friends, Joey talks about a moo point.
I missed that one.
That's very relevant in Wisconsin, definitely.
right, I guess so.
Well, one word on your list that I sometimes steer clear of, and it's in this category of things that look like they should be maybe pronounced in a French way, is, am I standing in a foyer or a foyer?
Mm. Yeah, I just heard of that on a TV show last night. Foyer or foyer, I just say lobby or something like that, because that's one of those words that we refer to as a skunked word, because either way you pronounce it, somebody is going to have a problem with it. The best pronunciation supposedly is foyer and not foyer, which sounds more affected, supposedly.
And let's
like you said, Veronica, sometimes I just try to word my way around things like that, because as I said, terms like foyer or fort instead of forte, they, you know, people, you're going to offend somebody.
Well, another one of your words, Martha, was P-U-N-D-I-T. Tell us about that one.
Yes. Pundit, and more, especially in this election year, I'm hearing people say pundit.
Pundit.
You've heard that one?
I don't know if I've heard that much.
Just from Rob.
Huh?
No, not really.
I just heard somebody say it last night on TV, because I'm following the elections, and somebody said pundit. You know who says pundit? Listen to Bernie Sanders.
Huh.
Bernie Sanders is pundit. He sticks an N in there between the I and the T, and it's not in there. And I don't know how he spells it, but he pronounces it in a way that's non-standard, pundit. It goes back to a Sanskrit word, pandit, which means a learned man.
Well, that's an interesting one. Maybe we'll have to tweet at Bernie Sanders and correct his pronunciation.
Or
maybe not.
Well, I don't know about that.
We'll say Martha Barnett says.
I mean, plenty of people say it. Mm-hmm.
Martha Barnett is with us now. We're talking about words that we mispronounce. She's the co-host of the public radio show, Away With Words.
She's the pundit when it comes to language. And we want to hear from you. What word do you wonder if you're pronouncing correctly? Does it bug you when you hear people mispronounce words? What's your vote for most frequently mispronounced word? Have you said a word? Have you gotten it wrong before and maybe corrected other people only to be recorrected yourself? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're back with Martha Barnett, co-host of the public radio show Away With Words. And we're talking about which words we mispronounce the most often and whether or not it's actually even worth caring about.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Which word do you hear mispronounced most often? Do you correct people? Should we correct people? What words do you have trouble with? Which ones do you stumble over? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now with Roxy in Luxembourg. Roxy, hi.
Hi there. My family corrects me or mocks me, and is it an all-you-can-eat buffet or is it all-you-can-eat buffet? Buffet or buffet?
Buffet.
What do you say?
Which side are you on, Roxy?
I don't know. I guess I usually say, oh, it's a buffet.
So, but do you know people who say buffet?
Yeah.
Huh. That's not one I've encountered, Roxy. Martha, is that one you've run into?
I said it that way growing up, buffet. And oh. I think I got it from my mother, and I think she was thinking it was sort of Frenchified, and that's why she said it that way. But in American English, it's buffet.
I wonder, I mean, because you could be Martha Barnett and I could be Rob Ferret if people overdid this Frenchifying thing.
I like
that's
those.
That's true. Originally, I didn't have an E on the end of my name, but when my hillbilly family moved from the mountains to the town, my Aunt Mazo added an E just to look Frenchified.
Well, you could also be Martha Barnetti.
I could.
Slight twist
that
on that.
Before,
all right, Roxy, thanks a lot for that. We're going to go next to Tina in Lake Geneva. Tina, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Thanks
for putting me on the air. I say we definitely correct people. It's the only thing that separates us from the animal kingdom is our ability to perfect our speech. It is buffet. And it is a grand foyer if you live in the South, and it's a foyer if you're in Arkansas.
Huh.
So a lot of it's colloquialism, but my pet peeve is people who make up words. I'm an educator. I hear other teachers that I work with say, look it to students.
Instead of look
directing
at.
Them, instead of look at. They say, look it. Look it is not a word. It's nowhere in an English dictionary.
So they allied to words.
Yes.
I don't know. I might be inclined to take a lighter hand with that one, but I don't know. I'm not an educator. What do you think about that one, Martha?
I have heard that a lot in Wisconsin, as a matter of fact. I didn't hear it looking up. I'm sorry, I didn't hear it growing up in Kentucky, but I'm looking in the Dictionary of American Regional English based there in Madison, mm-hmm. and it looks like it's sometimes pronounced look it, mm-hmm. indeed. So I would say it's a regional expression.
That's an interesting one.
Not excruciatingly correct standard English. And you know what? I do have to apologize to your caller before, because I have found buffet in the American Heritage Dictionary as we're sitting here. I'm not seeing it in others. But that sort of proves our point, doesn't it? That you can't always take one dictionary at its word. Because
right.
Different dictionaries say different things about pronunciation. So I would say go to the buffet and bon appetit.
Well, I'm just going to give up then, I think. We'll go back to our callers, though. We've got James on the line in Madison. James, hi.
Hi, guys. Great show. Thanks for sharing. So I explained this is technically my brother's story, but since he lives out of state, I'm taking license of sharing on his behalf. I recall him telling me when he was in high school, I believe it was his English class, they encountered the phrase faux pas, which having not heard before, he pronounced fox pas. And his snooty classmate quickly rebutted him, saying, oh, you mean faux pas, with her nose held high in the air. So
James,
those French ones tend to get us.
Thanks for that. And, you know, that's one I probably mispronounced it at some point in my life because I, like a lot of words, probably read it before I heard it. Martha, this is more etiquette than language, but... is there a right way, a nice way, a polite way to helpfully give the right pronunciation without, you know, being condescending about it?
Oh, you're absolutely right. I'm identifying with the time in fourth grade when I was trying to read a story to the class and I was talking about a character named Penelope. And I finally got corrected. You know, somebody told me it was Penelope. But those kinds of moments can be absolutely humiliating. You're absolutely right. I mean, if you're going to correct somebody, we say this all the time on the show, if you're going to correct somebody, please, number one, make sure that you're right. And number two, do it in private. Take this person aside privately. And really... There's no reason to play gotcha. You can use it as the start of a conversation.
Well, thanks to James for that. And I actually say, I kind of like fox paws.
Yeah.
I think we should all start
saying
that.
We're going to try to make that a thing.
Let's make that a thing.
Yeah, kind of gingerly. Yeah, yeah.
It's a sort of mistake that make even the clever fox pause for a moment.
See? You can rationalize that one. All right, James, thanks so much for the call. And we're going to go next to Tim in Amherst. Tim, hello.
Hi. I have a question. I am a very bad speller. So if I can't spell a word, how am I supposed to know how to pronounce it?
Fair question. Martha.
Ooh, if you can't, yeah. I guess listen very carefully to how folks you admire and respect are pronouncing things. I completely identify. But, I will tell you that one of the best writers I ever knew when I worked at the Louisville Courier-Journal in Kentucky was the world's worst speller. So some of us just don't have that gift, but yeah, I'm not sure I can offer advice for that.
We're talking about mispronounced words with Martha Barnett from the radio show Away with Words. Our next caller is Dave on the line in Madison. Dave, hi.
Hello. I've got one that I've noticed it for a number of years, and it's always, whenever I've heard it, it kind of grabbed me. I always say strength, the strength of a physical substance.
Uh-huh.
But I hear on the radio and hear other places where it's the strength of something.
Strength.
And I'd like to know if I'm just blowing that word or what.
The E changed a little, and this sounds like the G gets dropped there, Martha.
Yes, the G gets dropped, and it's like length. Some people say length. And it's sort of in that same family of words where some people say height instead of height. They add an H on the end of that. And it's not a standard pronunciation. And, but you do hear it a lot.
Well, thanks so much for that call. And a quick one here from Margaret in Wisconsin Rapids. Margaret, hi.
We have a difference of opinion in our family on how to pronounce coupon. Some of us say coupon and some say coupon.
Coupon.
And we don't know if that's a regional thing.
The correct answer is coupon.
You're turning everything French today, Rob. I don't know. What do you think, Martha?
Yeah, I'm looking in one dictionary and it says just coupon.
Really?
It does come from French, from coupé, meaning to cut. So that's probably why some people are saying coupon. But, that's one of those that can go either way. And that's one of the fun things to argue about, right?
Coupon or coupon? Well, clearly what we
I'm
need to
coupon
do is
guy, yeah.
drop French words from
guy?
The language.
Yeah. One of my favorites is theater. I had a friend who said it theater. And I looked it up in a dictionary, and that was an allowable one. So maybe the lesson here, Martha, is we shouldn't lose too much sleep because most of the time both ways are right.
That's absolutely true. And, you can look up in different dictionaries, as I said. Some of them have different things. I mean, I'm looking at the American Heritage right now, and I don't see that pronunciation that you're mentioning. But I'm sure if I opened up something else, like the Dictionary of American Regional English based there in Madison, I'm sure I would see theater. I think the bottom line is that we have a lot of differences in pronunciation, and a lot of them are to be celebrated.
All right. That's a good place to leave it. Thanks to Martha Barnett from Away with Words. You can catch her Sunday mornings at 9 on the Ideas Network. Keep this mispronunciation conversation going on the Central Time Facebook page. Today is a magical day for those of us with mild levels of mathematical nerdiness. It's, wait for it, it's a square root day.
Which means that the first 2 days of the date are the same number, and you multiply them together to get the year. So April 4th, 2016, 4/4/16, 4 squared equals 16.
So, all right, we got this today. The last one, 2009, 339, March 3rd, 2009. Next one, not going to come for another 9 years. In 2025, there will be 5 525. All told, there are 9 square root days every century.
So this is kind of a special day.
Right. So we've got to celebrate.
The next question is, how does one celebrate square root day?
I found this square root day website. They recommended merging this with baseball's opening day so you can root for the home team. Mm. Plus, they say it's a good day to get things squared away.
So this is basically just bad math puns.
I think so. Say, you know, we had Pi Day earlier, but this seems a little more special because there isn't one every year. So I'm kind of, and I like little nerdy math number stuff sometimes. I only set microwaves to prime numbers.
Where was your square root day office cake, I asked you?
Well, okay, maybe next time, 9 years from now.
All right, I'll keep waiting.
Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time.